Side 4, Mona Lisa Overdrive, by William Gibson. Continuing on page 143. There were gliders tethered there, translucent membrane drawn taut over fragile-looking frames of polycarbon. They quivered slightly in the morning breeze. Robin Lanier was waiting beside them, handsome, easy Robin, in a rough black sweater, who played opposite Angie in almost all her stims. And she was leaving the car now, taking to the field, laughing when her heels sank into the grass, and the rest of the way to Robin with her shoes in her hand, grinning, into his arms and his smell, his eyes. A whirl, a dance of editing, condensing the business of boarding the glider on the silver induction rail, and they were flung smoothly down the length of the field, lifting now, banking to catch the wind, and up, up, until the great house was an angular pebble in a swath of green, green cut by a dull gleam of curving river. And Pryor's hand on stop, smell of food from the cart beside the bed knotting her stomach, the dull sick ache of whiz crash in every joint. "Eat," he said. "We're leaving soon." He took the metal cover from one of the plates. "Club sandwich," he said. "Coffee, pastries. Doctor's orders. Once you're at the clinic, you won't be eating for a while."
"Clinic?"
"Gerald's place, Baltimore."
"Why?"
"Gerald's a cosmetic surgeon. You're having some work done. All of it reversible later, if you want, but we think you'll be pleased with the results." "Very pleased." The smile. "Anyone ever tell you how much you look like Angie, Mona?" She looked up at him, said nothing, managed to sit up, to drink half a cup of watery black coffee. She couldn't bring herself to look at the sandwich, but she ate one of the pastries. It tasted like cardboard. Baltimore. She wasn't too sure where that was. And somewhere a glider hung forever above a tame green country, fur against her shoulder, and Angie must still be there, still laughing. An hour later, in the lobby, while Pryor signed the bill, she saw Eddie's black gator clone suitcases go by on a robot baggage cart, and that was when she knew for sure that he was dead. Gerald's office had a sign with big old-fashioned letters, fourth floor of a condo rack in what Pryor said was Baltimore, the kind of building where they throw up a framework and commercial tenants bring their own modules, plug-ins, like a high-rise trailer camp, everything snaked with bundled cables, optics, lines for sewage and water.
"What's it say?" she asked Pryor.
"Gerald Chin, dentist."
"You said he was a plastic surgeon."
"He is."
"Why can't we just go to a boutique like everybody else?"
He didn't answer. She couldn't really feel much now, and part of her knew that she wasn't as scared as she should be. Maybe that was okay, though, because if she got scared enough, she wouldn't be able to do anything, and definitely she wanted to get out of the whole deal, whatever it was. On the drive over, she'd discovered this lump in the pocket of Michael's jacket. It had taken her 10 minutes to figure out it was a shock rod, like nervous suits carried. It felt like a screwdriver handle with a pair of blunt metal horns where the shaft should be. It probably charged off wall current. She just hoped Michael had kept up the charge. She figured Pryor didn't know it was there. They were legal, most places, because they weren't supposed to do much permanent damage. But Lynette had known a girl who'd gotten worked over real bad with one and never got much better. If Pryor didn't know it was in her pocket, it meant he didn't know everything, and he had a stake in having her think he did. But then he hadn't known how much Eddie hated gambling. She couldn't feel much about Eddie, either, except she still figured he was dead. No matter how much they'd given him, he still wouldn't walk out without those cases. Even if he was going for a whole new wardrobe, he'd need to get all dressed up to go shopping for it. Eddie cared about clothes more than almost anything, and those gator cases were special. He'd got them off a hotel thief in Orlando, and they were the closest thing he had to a home. And anyway, now that she thought about it,
She couldn't see him going for a buyout bid, because what he wanted most in the whole world was to be part of some big deal. Once he was, he figured, people would start to take him seriously. So somebody finally took him seriously, she thought, as Pryor carried her bag into Gerald's clinic. But not the way Eddie wanted. She looked around at the 20-year-old plastic furniture, the stacks of Stimstar magazines with Jap writing. It looked like a Cleveland haircut place. There was nobody there, nobody behind the reception desk. Then Gerald came through a white door, wearing the kind of crinkled foil suit that paramedics wore for traffic accidents. "Lock the door," he said to Pryor through a blue paper mask that hid his nose, mouth, and chin. "Hello, Mona, if you'll step this way." He gestured toward the white door. She had her hand around the shock rod now, but she didn't know how to turn it on. She followed Gerald, Pryor taking up the rear. "Have a seat," Gerald said. She sat on a white enamel chair. He came close, looked at her eyes. "You need to rest, Mona. You're exhausted." There was a serrated stud on the shock rod's handle. "Press it? Forward? Back?" Gerald went to a white box with drawers, got something out. "Here," he said, extending a little tube thing with writing on the side. "This will help you." She barely felt the tiny measured spray. There was a black dot on the aerosol tube, just where her eyes tried to focus, growing. She remembered the old man showing her how you kill a catfish. Catfish has a hole in its skull, covered with skin. You take something stiff and skinny, a wire, even a broom straw did it, and you just slip it in. She remembered Cleveland, ordinary kind of day before it was time to get working, sitting up in Lynette's, looking at a magazine. Found this picture of Angie laughing in a restaurant with some other people. Everybody pretty, but beyond that, it was like they had this glow. Not really in the photograph, but it was there anyway. Something you feel. "Look," she said to Lynette, showing her the picture. "They got this glow." "It's called money," Lynette said. "It's called money. You just slip it in." 20. Hilton Swift. He arrived unannounced, as he always did, and alone, the net helicopter settling like a solitary wasp, stirring strands of seaweed across the damp sand. She watched from the rust-eaten railing as he jumped down, something boyish, almost bumbling in his apparent eagerness. He wore a long topcoat of brown tweed, unbuttoned. It showed the immaculate front of one of his candy-striped shirts, the prop wash stirring his brown blonde hair and fluttering his scent-net tie. Robin was right, she decided. He did look as though his mother dressed him. Perhaps it was deliberate, she thought, as he came striding up the beach, a feigned naivete. She remembered Porphyry once maintaining that major corporations were entirely independent of the human beings who composed the body corporate. This had seemed patently obvious to Angie, but the hairdresser had insisted that she'd failed to grasp his basic premise. Swift was SenseNet's most important human decision-maker. The thought of Porphyry made her smile. Swift, taking it as a greeting, beamed back at her. He offered her lunch in San Francisco. The helicopter was extremely fast. She countered by insisting on preparing him a bowl of dehydrated Swiss soup and microwaving a frozen brick of sourdough rye. She wondered, watching him eat, about his sexuality. In his late 30s, he somehow conveyed the sense of an extraordinarily bright teenager in whom the onset of puberty had been subtly delayed. Rumor, at one time or another, had supplied him with every known sexual preference, and with several that she assumed were entirely imaginary. None of them seemed at all likely to Angie. She'd known him since she'd come to SenseNet. He'd been well established in the upper echelons of production when she'd arrived, one of the top people in Tally Isham's team, and he'd taken an immediate professional interest in her. Looking back, she assumed that Legba had steered her into his path. He'd been so obviously on his way up, though she might not have seen it herself then, dazzled by the glitter and constant movement of the scene. Bobby had taken an instant dislike to him, bristling with a Barry Towner's inbred hostility to authority, but had generally managed to conceal it for the sake of her career. The dislike had been mutual, Swift greeting their split and Bobby's departure with obvious relief. "Hilton," she said, as she poured him a cup of the herbal tea he preferred to coffee, "what is it that's keeping Robin in London?" He looked up from the steaming cup. "Something personal, I think. Perhaps he's found a new friend." Bobby had always been Angie's friend to Hilton. Robin's friends tended to be young, male, and athletic. The muted erotic sequences in her stims with Robin were assembled from stock footage provided by Continuity and heavily treated by Rabel and his effects team. She remembered the one night they'd spent together, in a wind-blown house in southern Madagascar, his passivity and his patience. They'd never tried again, and she'd suspected that he feared that intimacy would undermine the illusion their stims projected so perfectly. "What did he think of me going into the clinic, Hilton? Did he tell you?" "I think he admired you for it. Someone told me recently that he's been telling people I'm crazy." He'd rolled up his striped shirt sleeves and loosened his tie. "I can't imagine Robin thinking that, let alone saying it. I know what he thinks of you. You know what gossip is in the net. Hilton, where's Bobby?" His brown eyes, very still. "Isn't that over, Angie?" "Hilton, you know. You must know. You know where he is. Tell me."
"We lost him."
"Lost him?"
"Security lost him. You're right, of course. We kept the closest possible track of him after he left you." He reverted to type. There was an edge of satisfaction in his voice.
"And what type was that?"
"I've never asked what brought you together," he said. "Security investigated both of you, of course. He was a petty criminal." She laughed.
"He wasn't even that.
You were unusually well represented, Angie, for an unknown. You know that your agents made it a key condition of your contract that we take Bobby Newmark on as well."
"Contracts have had stranger conditions, Hilton."
"And he went on salary as your companion."
"My friend."
Was Swift actually blushing? He broke eye contact, looked down at his hands. "When he left you, he went to Mexico. Mexico City. Security was tracing him, of course. We don't like to lose track of anyone who knows that much about the personal life of one of our stars. Mexico City is a very complicated place. We do know that he seemed to be trying to continue his previous career."
"He was hustling cyberspace?"
He met her eyes again. "He was seeing people in the business, known criminals."
"And? Go on."
"He faded out, vanished." "Do you have any idea what Mexico City is like if you slip below the poverty line?"
"And he was poor?"
"He'd become an addict, according to our best sources."
"An addict? Addicted to what?"
"I don't know."
"Continuity?"
He almost spilled his tea. "Hello, Angie."
"Bobby, Continuity. Bobby Newmark, my friend,"
glaring at Swift.
"He went to Mexico City. Hilton says he became addicted to something. A drug, Continuity?"
"I'm sorry, Angie, that's classified data."
"Hilton."
"Continuity," he began and coughed. "Hello, Hilton." "Executive override, Continuity. Do we have that information?" "Security sources described Newmark's addiction as neuroelectronic."
"I don't understand."
"Some sort of, wirehead business," Swift offered.
She felt an impulse to tell him how she'd found the drug, the charger.
Hush, child.
Her head was full of the sound of bees, a building pressure.
Angie, what is it?
He was half up from his chair, reaching for her.
Nothing. I'm upset. I'm sorry. Nerves. It isn't your fault. I was going to tell you about finding Bobby's cyberspace deck, but you already know about that, don't you?
Can I get you anything? Water?
No, thanks. But I'll lie down for a while, if you don't mind. But stay, please. I have some ideas for orbital sequences that I'd like your advice on.
Of course. Have a nap. I'll have a walk on the beach, and then we'll talk. She watched him from the bedroom window, watched his brown figure recede in the direction of the colony, followed by the patient little Dornier. He looked like a child on the empty beach. He looked as lost as she felt.
21. The Aleph.
As the sun rose, still no power for the 100-watt bulbs, Gentry's loft filled with a new light. Winter sunlight softened the outlines of the consoles and the hollow table, brought out the texture of the ancient books that lined sagging chipboard shelves along the west wall. As Gentry paced and talked, his blonde rooster tail bobbing each time he spun on a black boot heel, his excitement seemed to counter the lingering effects of Cherry's sleep derms. Cherry sat on the edge of the bed, watching Gentry, but glancing occasionally at the battery telltale on the stretcher's superstructure. Slick sat in a broken-down chair, scrounged from the solitude, and recushioned with transparent plastic over wadded pads of discarded clothing. To Slick's relief, Gentry had skipped the whole business of the shape and launched straight into his theory about the Aleph thing. As always, once Gentry got going, he used words and constructions that Slick had trouble understanding. But Slick knew from experience that it was easier not to interrupt him. The trick was in pulling some kind of meaning out of the overall flow, skipping over the parts you didn't understand. Gentry said that the count was jacked into what amounted to a mother-huge Microsoft. He thought the slab was a single solid lump of biochip. If that was true, the thing's storage capacity was virtually infinite. It would have been unthinkably expensive to manufacture. It was, Gentry said, a fairly strange thing for anyone to have built at all, although such things were rumored to exist and to have their uses, most particularly in the storage of vast amounts of confidential data. With no link to the global matrix, the data was immune to every kind of attack via cyberspace. The catch, of course, was that you couldn't access it via the matrix. It was dead storage. He could have anything in there, Gentry said, pausing to look down at the unconscious face. He spun on his heel and began his pacing again. A world, worlds, any number of personality constructs.
Like he's living a stim? Cherry asked. That's why he's always in REM?
No, Gentry said. It's not SimStim. It's completely interactive. And it's a matter of scale. If this is Aleph-class Biosoft, he literally could have anything at all in there. In a sense, he could have an approximation of everything.
I got a feeling off Kid Africa, Cherry said, that this guy was paying to stay this way. Kind of wirehead action, but different. And anyway, wireheads don't REM like that.
But when you tried to put it out through your stuff, Slick ventured, you got that thing. He saw Gentry's shoulders tense beneath black beaded leather. Yes, Gentry said. And now I have to reconstruct our account with the Fission Authority. He pointed at the permanent storage batteries stacked beneath the steel table. Get those out for me.
Yeah, Cherry said. It's about time. I'm freezing my ass.
They left Gentry bent over a cyberspace deck and went back to Slick's room. Cherry had insisted they rig Gentry's electric blanket to one of the batteries so she could drape it over the stretcher. There was cold coffee left on the butane stove. Slick drank it without bothering to reheat it, while Cherry stared out the window at the snow-streaked plain of the solitude.
How'd it get like this? She asked.
Gentry says it was a landfill operation 100 years ago. Then they laid down a lot of topsoil, but stuff wouldn't grow. A lot of the fill was toxic. Rain washed the cover off. Guess they just gave up and started dumping more shit on it. Can't drink the water out there. Full of PCBs and everything else. What about those rabbits Bird Boy goes hunting for? They're west of here. You don't see 'em on the Solitude. Not even rats. Anyway, you gotta test any meat you take around here.
There's birds, though.
Just roost here. Go somewhere else to feed.
What is it with you and Gentry?
She was still looking out the window. How do you mean?
My first idea was maybe you were gay. Together, I mean.
No.
But it's kind of like you need each other some way.
It's his place, factory. Lets me live here. I need to live here. To do my work.
To build those things downstairs?
The bulb in the yellow cone of fax came on. The fan in the heater kicked in.
Well, Cherry said, squatting in front of the heater and unzipping one jacket after another, he may be crazy, but he just did something right.
Gentry was slouched in the old office chair when Slick entered the loft, staring at the little flip-up monitor on his deck. Robert Newmark, Gentry said.
Huh?
Retinal identification. Either this is Robert Newmark, or someone who bought his eyes.
How'd you get that?
Slick bent to peer at the screen of basic birth stats. Gentry ignored the question. This is it. Push it and you run into something else entirely.
How's that?
Someone wants to know if anyone asks any questions about Mr. Newmark.
Who?
I don't know. Gentry drummed his fingers on his black leather thighs. Look at this. Nothing. Born in Berrytown. Mother, Marcia Newmark. We've got his sin, but it's definitely been tagged. He shoved the chair back on its casters and swung around so that he could see the Count's still face. How about it, Newmark? Is that your name? He stood up and went to the hollow table.
Don't, Slick said.
Gentry touched the power stud on the hollow table. And the gray thing was there again for an instant, but this time it dived toward the core of the hemispherical display, dwindled, and was gone.
No, it was there, a minute gray sphere at the very center of the glowing projection field.
Gentry's crazy smile had returned.
Good, he said.
What's good? I see what it is, a kind of ice. A security program.
That monkey?
Someone has a sense of humor. If the monkey doesn't scare you off, it turns into a pea. He crossed to the table and began to root through one of the panniers. I doubt if they'll be able to do that with a direct sensory link. He held something in his hand now. A trode net.
Gentry, don't do it! Look at him!
I'm not going to do it, Gentry said.
You are.
22. Ghosts and Empties. Staring through the cab's smudged windows, she found herself wishing for Colin and his wry commentary, then remembered that this was entirely beyond his sphere of expertise. Did Moss Neotech manufacture a similar unit for the sprawl, she wondered, and if so, what form would its ghost take?
Sally, she said, perhaps half an hour into the drive to New York, why did Petal let me go with you?
Because he was smart.
And my father?
Your father, oh shit.
I'm sorry?
We'll be angry, if he finds out. And he may not. We aren't here for long.
Why are we here?
I gotta talk to somebody.
But why am I here?
You don't like it here?
Kumiko hesitated. Yes, I do.
Good. Sally shifted on the broken-down seat. Petal had to let us go, because he couldn't have stopped us without hurting one of us. Well, maybe not hurting, more like insulting. Swain could cool you, then tell you he was sorry later. Tell your father it was for your own good, if it came to that. But if he cools me, it's like face, right? When I saw a pedal down there with the gun, I knew he was going to let us go. Your room's kinked. The whole place is. I set the motion sensors off when I was getting your gear together. Figured I would. Pedal knew it was me. That's why he rang the phone, to let me know he knew.
I don't understand.
Kind of a courtesy, so I'd know he was waiting. Give me a chance to think. But he didn't have a choice, and he knew it. Swain, see, he's being forced to do something, and Petal knows it. Or anyway, Swain says he is being forced. Me, I'm definitely being forced. So I start wondering how bad Swain needs me. Real bad. Because they let me walk off with the Oyabun's daughter, shipped all the way to Notting Hill for the safekeeping. Something there scares him worse than your daddy. Unless it's something that'll make him richer than your daddy already has. Anyway, taking you kind of evens things up. Kind of like pushing back. You mind?
But you are being threatened?
Somebody knows a lot of things I did.
And Tick has discovered the identity of this person?
Yeah. Guess I knew anyway. Wish to fuck I'd been wrong. The hotel Sally chose was faced with rust-stained steel panels, each panel secured with gleaming chrome bolts, a style Kumiko knew from Tokyo and thought of as somewhat old-fashioned. Their room was large and gray, a dozen shades of gray, and Sally walked straight to the bed after she'd locked the door, took off her jacket, and lay down.
"You don't have a bag?" Kumiko said.
Sally sat up and began to remove her boots. I can buy what I need. You tired?
No.
I am. She pulled her black sweater over her head. Her breasts were small, with brownish-pink nipples. A scar, running from just below the left nipple, vanished into the waistband of her jeans.
You were hurt, Kumiko said, looking at the scar.
Sally looked down. Yeah.
Why didn't you have it removed?
Sometimes it's good to remember.
Being hurt?
Being stupid. Gray on gray. Unable to sleep, Kumiko paced the gray carpet. There was something vampiric about the room, she decided. Something it would have in common with millions of similar rooms, as though its bewilderingly seamless anonymity were sucking away her personality, fragments of which emerged as her parents' voices raised in argument, as the faces of her father's black-suited secretaries. Sally slept, her face a smooth mask. The view from the window told Kumiko nothing at all, only that she looked out on a city that was neither Tokyo nor London, a vast generic tumble that was her century's paradigm of urban reality. Perhaps she slept too, Kumiko, though later she wasn't certain. She watched Sally order toiletries and underwear, tapping her requirements into the bedside video. Her purchases were delivered while Kumiko was in the shower.
Okay, Sally said from beyond the door. Towel off, get dressed. We're going to see the man.
What man? Kumiko asked, but Sally hadn't heard her. Gomi. 35% of the landmass of Tokyo was built on Gomi, on level tracts reclaimed from the bay through a century's systematic dumping. Gomi, there, was a resource to be managed, to be collected, sorted, carefully plowed under. London's relationship to Gomi was more subtle, more oblique. To Kumiko's eyes, the bulk of the city consisted of Gomi, of structures the Japanese economy would long ago have devoured in its relentless hunger for space in which to build. Yet these structures revealed, even to Kumiko, the fabric of time, each wall patched by generations of hands in an ongoing task of restoration. The English valued their Gomi in its own right, in a way she had only begun to understand. They inhabited it. Gomi in the sprawl was something else, a rich humus, a decay that sprouted prodigies in steel and polymer. The apparent lack of planning alone was enough to dizzy her, running so entirely opposite the value her own culture placed on efficient land use. Their taxi ride from the airport had already shown her decay, whole blocks in ruin, unglazed windows gaping above sidewalks heaped with trash, and faces staring as the armored hover made its way through the streets. Now Sally plunged her abruptly into the full strangeness of this place, with its rot and randomness rooting towers taller than any in Tokyo, corporate obelisks that pierced the sooty lacework of overlapping domes. Two cab rides away from their hotel, they took to the street itself, into early evening crowds and a slant of shadow. The air was cold, but not the cold of London, and Kumiko thought of the blossoms in Ueno Park. Their first stop was a large, somewhat faded bar called the Gentleman Loser, where Sally conducted a quiet, very rapid exchange with a bartender. They left without buying a drink. "Ghosts," Sally said, rounding a corner, Kumiko close at her side. The streets had grown progressively more empty these past several blocks, the buildings darker and more decrepit.
"Pardon me?"
"A lot of ghosts here for me, or anyway there should be."
"You know this place?"
"Sure. Looks all the same, but different, you know."
"No."
"Someday you will. We find who I'm looking for. You just do your good girl routine. Speak if you're spoken to, otherwise don't."
"Who are we looking for?"
"The man. What's left of him, anyway." Half a block on, the grim street empty. Kumiko had never seen an empty street before, aside from Swain's Crescent shrouded in midnight snow. Sally came to a halt beside an ancient and utterly unpromising storefront, its twin display windows silvered with a rich inner coating of dust. Peering in, Kumiko made out the glass tube letters of an unlit neon sign, Metro, then a longer word. The door between the windows had been reinforced with a sheet of corrugated steel. Rusting eye bolts protruded at intervals, strung with slack lengths of galvanized razor wire. Now Sally faced that door, squared her shoulders, and executed a fluid series of small, quick gestures. Kumiko stared as the sequence was repeated.
"Sally?"
"Jive," Sally cut her off. "I told you to shut up, okay?"
"Yeah?"
The voice, barely more than a whisper, seemed to come from nowhere in particular. "I told you already," Sally said.
"I don't jive."
"I want to talk to him," she said, her voice hard and careful.
"He's dead."
"I know that." A silence followed, and Kumiko heard a sound that might have been the wind, a cold, grit-laden wind scouring the curve of the geodesics far above them.
"He's not here,"
the voice said, and seemed to recede. Round the corner, half a block, left into the alley. Kumiko would remember the alley always. Dark brick, slick with damp, hooded ventilators trailing black streamers of congealed dust, a yellow bulb in a cage of corroded alloy, the low growth of empty bottles that sprouted at the base of either wall, the man-sized nests of crumpled facts and white foam packing segments, and the sound of Sally's boot heels. Past the bulb's dim glow was darkness, though a reflected gleam on wet brick showed a final wall, cul-de-sac, and Kumiko hesitated, frightened by a sudden stir of echo, a scurrying, the steady dripping of water. Sally raised her hand. A tight beam of very bright light framed a sharp circle of paint-scrawled brick, then smoothly descended. Descended until it found the thing at the base of the wall. Dull metal. An upright, rounded figure that Kumiko mistook for another ventilator. Near its base were the stubs of white candles, a flat plastic flask filled with a clear liquid, an assortment of cigarette packets, a scattering of loose cigarettes, and an elaborate, multi-armed figure drawn in what appeared to be white powdered chalk. Sally stepped forward, the beam held steady, and Kumiko saw that the armored thing was bolted into the brickwork with massive rivets.
"Finn?"
A rapid flicker of pink light from a horizontal slot. Hey, Finn, man.
An uncharacteristic hesitation in her voice.
Maul.
A grating quality, as if through a broken speaker.
What's with the flash? You still got amps in? Getting old, you can't see in the dark so good.
For my friend. Something moved behind the slot, its color the unhealthy pink of hot cigarette ash in noon sunlight, and Kumiko's face was washed with a stutter of light.
Yeah, grated the voice. So who's she?
Yanaka's daughter.
No shit.
Sally lowered the light. It fell on the candles, the flask, the damp gray cigarettes, the white symbol with its feathery arms.
Help yourself to the offerings, said the voice. That's half a liter of Moskovskaya there. The hoodoo marks flour. Tough luck. The high rollers draw 'em in cocaine.
Jesus, Sally said, an odd distance in her voice, squatting down. I don't believe this. Kumiko watched as she picked up the flask and sniffed at the contents.
Drink it. It's good shit. Fucking better be. Nobody short counts the Oracle, not if they know what's good for 'em.
Finn, Sally said, then tilted the flask and swallowed, wiping her mouth with the back of her hand. You gotta be crazy.
I should be so lucky. A rig like this, I'm pushing it to have a little imagination, let alone crazy.
Kumiko moved closer, then squatted beside Sally. It's a construct? A personality job? Sally put down the flask of vodka and stirred the damp flour with the tip of a white fingernail.
Sure, you've seen 'em before. Real-time memory if I wanna, wired into C-space if I wanna. Got this Oracle gig to keep my hand in, you know.
The thing made a strange sound. Laughter.
Got love troubles? Got a bad woman don't understand you?
The laugh noise again, like peals of static.
Actually, I'm more into business advice. If the local kids leave the goodies. Adds to the mystique, kinda. And once in a while I get a skeptic. Some asshole figures he'll help himself to the take.
A scarlet hairline flashed from the slit, and a bottle exploded somewhere to Kumiko's right. Static laughter.
So what brings you this way, Maul? You and...
Again, the pink light flicked across Kumiko's face.
Yanaka's daughter.
The stray light run, Sally said.
Long time, Maul.
She's after me, Finn. 14 years... And that crazy bitch is on my ass.
So maybe she's got nothing better to do. You know how rich folks are.
You know where Case is, Finn. Maybe she's after him.
Case got out of it. Rolled up a few good scores after you split. Then he kicked it in the head and quit clean. If you did the same, maybe you wouldn't be freezing your buns off in an alley, right? Last I heard, he had 4 kids.
Watching the hypnotic sweep of the scanning pink ember, Kumiko had some idea of what it was that Sally spoke with. There were similar things in her father's study, 4 of them, black lacquered cubes arranged along a low shelf of pine. Above each cube hung a formal portrait. The portraits were monochrome photographs of men in dark suits and ties, 4 very sober gentlemen whose lapels were decorated with small metal emblems of the kind her father sometimes wore. Though her mother had told her that the cubes contained ghosts, the ghosts of her father's evil ancestors, Kumiko found them more fascinating than frightening. If they did contain ghosts, she reasoned, they would be quite small, as the cubes themselves were scarcely large enough to contain a child's head. Her father sometimes meditated before the cubes, kneeling on the bare tatami in an attitude that connoted profound respect. She had seen him in this position many times, but she was 10 before she heard him address the cubes, and 1 had answered. The question had meant nothing to her, the answer less, but the calm tone of the ghost's reply had frozen her where she crouched,
behind a door of paper, and her father had laughed to find her there. Rather than scolding her, he'd explained that the cubes housed the recorded personalities of former executives, corporate directors. "Their souls?" she'd asked. "No," he'd said, and smiled, then added that the distinction was a subtle one. "They are not conscious. They respond, when questioned, in a manner approximating the response of the subject. If they are ghosts, then holograms are ghosts." After Sally's lecture on the history and hierarchy of the Yakuza in the Robata bar in Earl's Court, Kumiko had decided that each of the men in the photographs, the subjects of the personality recordings, had been an Oyabun. The thing in the armored housing, she reasoned, was of a similar nature, though perhaps more complex, just as Colin was a more complex version of the Michelin guide her father's secretaries had carried on her Shinjuku shopping expeditions. Finn, Sally called it, and it was evident that this Finn had been a friend or associate of hers. But did it wake, Kumiko wondered, when the alley was empty? Did its laser vision scan the silent fall of midnight snow? "Europe," Sally began. "When I split from Case, I went all around there. Had a lot of money we got for the run. Anyway, it looked like a lot then. Tessier Ashpool's AI paid it out through a Swiss bank. It erased every trace we'd ever been up the well. I mean everything. Like if you looked up the names we traveled under, on the JAL shuttle, they just weren't there. Case checked it all out when we were back in Tokyo. Wormed his way into all kinds of data. It was like none of it ever happened. I didn't understand how it could do that, AI or not, but nobody ever really understood what happened up there, when Case rode that Chinese icebreaker through their core ice. Did it try to get in touch? After?" "Not that I know of. He had this idea that it was gone, sort of. Not gone, gone, but gone into everything, the whole matrix. Like it wasn't in cyberspace anymore, it just was. And if it didn't want you to see it, to know it was there, well, there was no way you ever could. And no way you'd ever be able to prove it to anybody else, even if you did know. And me, I didn't want to know. I mean, whatever it was, it seemed done to me. Finished. Armitage was dead. Riviera was dead. Ashpool was dead. The Rasta tug pilot who took us out there was back in Zion Cluster, and he'd probably written it all off as another ganja dream. I left Case in the Tokyo Hyatt. Never saw him again."
"Why?"
"Who knows? Nothing much. I was young. It just seemed over."
"But you'd left her up the well. In Straylight."
"You got it. And I'd think about that once in a while. When we were leaving, Finn, it was like she didn't care about any of it. Like I'd killed her crazy sick father for her, and Case had cracked their cores and let their AIs loose in the Matrix. So I put her on the list, right? You get big enough trouble one day, you're being got at, you check that list."
"And you figured it for her right off?"
"No, I got a pretty long list. Case, who seemed to Kumiko to have been something more than Sally's partner, never re-entered her story." As Kumiko listened to Sally condense 14 years of personal history for the Finn's benefit, she found herself imagining this younger Sally as a Bishonen hero in a traditional romantic video, fey, elegant and deadly, while she found Sally's matter-of-fact account of her life difficult to follow with its references to places and things she didn't know. It was easy to imagine her winning the sudden flick-of-the-wrist victories expected of Bishonen. But no, she thought, as Sally dismissed a bad year in Hamburg, sudden anger in her voice. An old anger, the year, a decade past. It was a mistake to cast this woman in Japanese terms. There were no ronin, no wandering samurai. Sally and the Finn were talking business. She'd arrived at her bad year in Hamburg, Kumiko gathered, after having won and lost some sort of fortune. She'd won her share of it up there, in a place the Finn had called Straylight, in partnership with the man Case. In doing so, she'd made an enemy,
Hamburg, the Finn interrupted. I heard stories about Hamburg.
The money was gone. How it is with a big score when you're young. No money was sort of like getting back to normal, but I was involved with these Frankfurt people, Odom, and they wanted to take it out in trade.
What kind of trade?
They wanted people hit.
So?
So I got out, when I could, went to London. Perhaps, Kumiko decided, Sally had once been something along Ronin lines, a kind of samurai. In London, however, she'd become something else, a businesswoman. Supporting herself in some unspecified way, she gradually became a backer, providing funds for various kinds of business operations. What was a credit sink? What was laundering data?
Yeah, the Finn said. You did okay. Got yourself a share in some German casino.
Aix-la-Chapelle. I was on the board. Still am when I got the right passport.
Settled down?
The laugh again. Sure.
Didn't hear much back here.
I was running a casino. That was it. Doing fine.
You were prize fighting. Misty Steel, augmented featherweight. 8 fights. I made book on 5 of them. Blood matches, sweet meat. Illegal.
Hobby.
Some hobby. I saw the vids. Burmese kid opened you right up. Living color.
Kumiko remembered the long scar. So I quit. 5 years ago, and I was already 5 years too old.
You weren't bad, but Misty Steel? Jesus.
Give me a break. Wasn't me made that one up.
Sure. So tell me about our friend upstairs, how she got in touch.
Swain, Roger Swain, sends one of his boys to the casino, would-be hard-ass called Pryor, about a month ago.
Swain the fixer? London?
Same one. So Pryor's got a present for me, about a meter of printout, a list, names, dates, places.
Bad?
Everything. Stuff I'd almost forgotten.
Straylight run?
Everything. So I packed a bag, got back to London. There's Swain. He's sorry, it's not his fault, but he's got to twist me, because somebody's twisting him. Got his own meter of printout to worry about.
Kumiko heard Sally's heels shift on the pavement. What's he want?
A rip, warm body, celeb.
Why you?
Come on, Finn. That's what I'm here to ask you.
Swain tell you it's 3 Jane?
No, but my consul cowboy in London did.
Kumiko's knees ached. The kid, where'd you come by her?
She turned up at Swain's place. Yanaka wanted her out of Tokyo. Swain owes him giri.
She's clean anyway, no implants. What I get out of Tokyo lately, Yanaka has his hands for.
Kumiko shivered in the dark.
And the rip? The celeb? The Finn continued.
She felt Sally hesitate. Angela Mitchell.
The pink metronome swinging silently, left to right, right to left.
It's cold here, Finn.
Yeah. Wish I could feel it. I just took a little trip on your behalf. Memory lane. You know much about where Angie comes from?
No.
I'm in the Oracle game, honey, not a research library. Her father was Christopher Mitchell. He was the big shit in biochip research at Mass Bio Labs. She grew up in a sealed compound of theirs in Arizona, company kid. About 7 years ago, something happened down there. The street said Hosaka fielded a team of pros to help Mitchell make a major career move. The facts said there was a megaton blast on Mass property, but nobody ever found any radiation. Never found Hosaka's mercs either. Mass announced that Mitchell was dead. Suicide.
That's the library. What's the Oracle now?
Rumors. Nothing that hangs together on a line.
Street said she turned up here a day or two after the blast in Arizona. Got in with some very weird spades who worked out of New Jersey.
Worked what?
They dealt. Where, mostly? Buying, selling. Sometimes they bought from me.
How were they weird?
Hoodoos. Thought the Matrix was full of mambos and shit. Wanna know something, Maul?
What?
They're right.
23. Mirror, mirror. She came out of it like somebody had thrown a switch. Didn't open her eyes. She could hear them talking in another room. Hurt lots of places, but not any worse than the whiz had. The bad crash, that was gone, or maybe muted by whatever they'd given her, that spray. Paper smock coarse against her nipples. They felt big and tender, and her breasts felt full. Little lines of pain tweaking across her face, twin dull aches in her eye sockets, sore rough feeling in her mouth, and a taste of blood. I'm not trying to tell you your business, Gerald was saying, above a running tap and a rattle of metal, like he was washing pans or something. But you're kidding yourself if you think she'd fool anyone who didn't want to be fooled. It's really a very superficial job. Pryor said something she couldn't make out. I said superficial, not shoddy. That's quality work, all of it. 24 hours on a dermal stimulator, and you won't know she's been here. Keep her on the antibiotics and off stimulants. Her immune system isn't all it could be. Then Pryor again, but she still couldn't catch it. Opened her eyes, but there was only the ceiling, white squares of acoustic tile. Turned her head to the left, white plastic wall with one of those fake windows, high-res animation of a beach with palm trees and waves. Watch the water long enough and you'd see the same waves rolling in, looped, forever. Except the thing was broken or worn out, a kind of hesitation in the waves, and the red of the sunset pulsed like a bad fluorescent tube. Try right. Turning again, feeling the sweaty paper cover on the hard foam pillow against her neck. And the face with bruised eyes looking at her from the other bed, nose braced with clear plastic and micropore tape, some kind of brown jelly stuff smeared back across the cheekbones. Angie. It was Angie's face, framed by the reflected sunset stutter of the defective window. There was no bone work, Gerald said, carefully loosening the tape that held the little plastic brace in place along the bridge of her nose. That was the beauty of it. We planed some cartilage in the nose, working in through the nostrils, then went on to the teeth. Smile. Beautiful. We did the breast augmentation, built up the nipples with vat-grown erectile tissue, then did the eye coloration. He removed the brace. You mustn't touch this for another 24 hours.
That how I got the bruises?
No. That's secondary trauma from the cartilage job.
Gerald's fingers were cool on her face. Precise. That should clear up by tomorrow.
Gerald was okay. He'd given her 3 derms, 2 blue and a pink, smooth and comfortable.
Pryor definitely wasn't okay, but he was gone or anyway out of sight. And it was just nice listening to Gerald explain things in his calm voice. And look what he could do.
Freckles, she said, because they were gone.
Abrasion and more vat tissue. They'll come back, faster if you get too much sun.
She's so beautiful.
She turned her head. You, Mona, that's you. She looked at the face in the mirror and tried on that famous smile.
Maybe Gerald wasn't okay.
Back in the narrow white bed again, where he'd put her to rest, she raised her arm and looked at the 3 derms. Trank. Floating. She worked a fingernail under the pink derm and peeled it off, stuck it on the white wall and pushed hard with her thumb. A single bead of straw-colored fluid ran down. She carefully peeled it back and replaced it on her arm. The stuff in the blue ones was milky white. She put them back on, too. Maybe he'd notice, but she wanted to know what was happening.
She looked in the mirror. Gerald said he could put it back the way it was some day, if she wanted him to. But then she wondered how he'd remember what she'd looked like. Maybe he'd taken a picture or something. Now that she thought about it, maybe there wasn't anybody who'd remember how she'd looked before. She guessed Michael's stim deck was probably the closest bet, but she didn't know his address or even his last name. It gave her a funny feeling, like who she'd been had wandered away down the street for a minute and never come back. But then she closed her eyes and knew she was Mona, always had been, and that nothing much had changed, anyway, not behind her eyelids. Lynette said it didn't matter how you got yourself changed. Lynette told her once that she didn't have 10% of her own face left, the one she'd been born with. Not that you'd guess, except for the black around her lids, so she never had to mess with mascara. Mona had thought maybe Lynette hadn't got such good work done, and it must have shown once in Mona's eyes, because then Lynette said, "You should have seen me before, honey." But now here she was, Mona, stretched out straight in this skinny bed in Baltimore, and all she knew about Baltimore was the sound of a siren from down in the street and the motor running on Gerald's air conditioner. And somehow that turned into sleep. She didn't know for how long. And then Pryor was there with his hand on her arm, asking her if she was hungry. She watched Pryor shave his beard. He did it at the stainless surgical sink, trimming it back with a pair of chrome scissors. Then he switched to a white plastic throwaway razor from a box of them that Gerald had. It was strange watching his face come out. It wasn't a face she'd have expected. It was younger, but the mouth was the same. "We gonna be here much longer, Pryor?" He had his shirt off for the shave. He had tattoos across his shoulders and down his upper arms, dragons with lion heads. "Don't worry about it," he said. "It's boring." "We'll get you some stims." He was shaving under his chin. "What's Baltimore like?"
"Bloody awful, like the rest of it."
"So what's England like?"
"Bloody awful."
He wiped his face with a thick wad of blue absorbent paper. "Maybe we could go out, get some of those crabs. Gerald says they got crabs."
"They do," he said. "I'll get some in."
"How about you take me out?"
He tossed the blue wad into a steel waste canister. "No, you might try to run away."
She slid her hand between the bed and the wall and found the torn foam air cell where she'd hidden the shock rod. She'd found her clothes in a white plastic bag. Gerald came in every couple of hours with fresh derms. She'd wring them out as soon as he'd gone. She'd figured if she could get Pryor to take her out to eat, she could make a move in the restaurant. But he wasn't having any. In a restaurant, she might even be able to get a cop, because now she figured she knew what the deal was. Snuff. Lynette had told her about that. How there were men who'd pay to have girls fixed up to look like other people, then kill them. Had to be rich, really rich. Not Pryor, but somebody he worked for. Lynette said these guys had girls fixed to look like their wives sometimes. Mona hadn't really believed it back then. Sometimes Lynette told her scary stuff because it was fun to be scared when you knew you were pretty safe. And anyway, Lynette had a lot of stories about weird kinks. She said suits were the weirdest of all, the big suits way up in big companies, because they couldn't afford to lose control when they were working. But when they weren't working, Lynette said, they could afford to lose it any way they wanted. So why not a big suit somewhere who wanted Angie that way? Well, there were lots of girls got themselves worked over to look like her, but they were mostly pathetic, wannabes, and she hadn't ever seen one who really looked much like Angie. Anyway, not enough to fool anybody who cared. But maybe there was somebody who'd pay for all this just to get a girl who did look like Angie. Anyway, if it wasn't snuff, what was it? Now Pryor was buttoning his blue shirt. He came over to the bed and pulled the sheet down to look at her breasts, like he was looking at a car or something. She yanked the sheet back up. "I'll get some crabs." He put his jacket on and went out. She could hear him saying something to Gerald.
Gerald stuck his head in. How are you, Mona?
Hungry.
Feeling relaxed?
Yeah.
When she was alone again, she rolled over and studied her face, Angie's face, in the mirrored wall. The bruising was almost gone. Gerald taped things like miniature trodes to her face and hooked them to a machine. Said they made it heal real fast. It didn't make her jump now, Angie's face in the mirror. The teeth were nice. The teeth you'd want to keep anyway. She wasn't sure about the rest. Not yet. Maybe she should just get up now, get her clothes on, head for the door. If Gerald tried to stop her, she could use the rod. And she remembered how Pryor had turned up at Michael's, like he'd had somebody watching her all night, following her. Maybe somebody watching now, outside. Gerald's place didn't seem to have any windows, not real ones, so she'd have to go out the door. And she was starting to want her whiz bad, too. But if she did even a little, Gerald would notice. She knew her kit was there, and her bag under the bed. Maybe if she did some, she thought, she'd just do something. But maybe it wouldn't be the right thing. She had to admit that what she did on Wiz didn't always work out, even though it made you feel like you couldn't make a mistake if you tried. Anyway, she was hungry, and too bad Gerald didn't have some kind of music or something, so maybe she'd just wait for that crab. 24. In a lonely place. And Gentry standing there with the shape burning behind his eyes, holding out the trode net under the glare of bare bulbs, telling Slick why it had to be that way, why Slick had to put the trodes on and jack straight into whatever the gray slab was inputting to the still figure on the stretcher. He shook his head, remembering how he'd come to Dog Solitude. And Gentry started talking faster, taking the gesture for refusal. Gentry was saying Slick had to go under. He said maybe just for a few seconds, while he got a fix on the data and worked up a macro form. Slick didn't know how to do that, Gentry said, or he'd go under himself. It wasn't the data he wanted, just the overall shape, because he thought that would lead him to the shape, the big one, the thing he'd chased for so long. Slick remembered crossing the solitude on foot. He'd been scared that the Korsakoffs would come back, that he'd forget where he was and drink cancer water from the slimed red puddles on the rusty plain. Red scum and dead birds floating with their wings spread. The trucker from Tennessee had told him to walk west from the highway. He'd hit two-lane blacktop inside an hour and get a ride down to Cleveland. But it felt like longer than an hour now, and he wasn't so sure which way was west, and this place was spooking him. This junkyard scar, like a giant, had stomped it flat. Once he saw somebody far away, up on a low ridge, and waved. The figure vanished, but he walked that way, no longer trying to skirt the puddles, slogging through them, until he came to the ridge and saw that it was the wingless hulk of an airliner half buried in rusted cans. He made his way up the incline along a path where feet had flattened the cans, to a square opening that had been an emergency exit. Stuck his head inside and saw hundreds of tiny heads suspended from the concave ceiling. He froze there, blinking in the sudden shade, until what he was seeing made some kind of sense. The pink plastic heads of dolls, their nylon hair tied up into top knots, and the knots stuck into thick black tar, dangling like fruit. Nothing else, only a few ragged slabs of dirty green foam. And he knew he didn't want to stick around to find out whose place this was. He'd headed south then, without knowing it, and found Factory. "I'll never have another chance," Gentry said. Slick stared at the taut face, the eyes wide with desperation. "I'll never see it." And Slick remembered the time Gentry'd hit him, how he'd looked down at the wrench and felt... Well, Cherry wasn't right about them, but there was something else there. He didn't know what to call it. He snatched the trode net with his left hand and shoved Gentry hard in the chest with his right. "Shut up! Shut the fuck up!" Gentry fell back against the steel table's edge.
Slick cursed him softly as he fumbled the delicate net of contact dermatrodes across his forehead and temples. Jacked in. His boots crunched gravel, opened his eyes and looked down. The gravel drive smooth in the dawn, cleaner than anything in Dog Solitude. He looked up and saw where it curved away, and beyond green and spreading trees, the pitched slate roof of a house half the size of factory. There were statues near him in the long wet grass, a deer made of iron, and a broken figure of a man's body carved from white stone, no head or arms or legs. Birds were singing, and that was the only sound. He started walking up the drive, toward the gray house, because there didn't seem to be anything else to do. When he got to the head of the drive, he could see past the house to smaller buildings and a broad flat field of grass where gliders were staked against the wind. Fairy tale, he thought, looking up at the mansion's broad stone brow, the leaded diamond panes, like some vid he'd seen when he was little. Were there really people who lived in places like this? But it's not a place, he reminded himself. It only feels like it is. Gentry, he said. Get my ass out of this, okay? He studied the backs of his hands. Scars, ingrained grime, black half-moons of grease under his broken nails. The grease got in and made them soft, so they broke easy. He started to feel stupid standing there. Maybe somebody was watching him from the house. Fuck it, he said, and started up the broad flagstone walk, unconsciously hitching his stride into the swagger he'd learned in the Deacon Blues. The door had this thing fastened to a central panel, a hand, small and graceful, holding a sphere the size of a pool ball, all cast in iron, hinged at the wrist so you could raise it and bring it down. He did, hard, twice, then twice again. Nothing happened. The doorknob was brass, floral detail worn almost invisible by years of use. It turned easily. He opened the door. He blinked at a wealth of color and texture, surfaces of dark polished wood, black and white marble, rugs with a thousand soft colors that glowed like church windows, polished silver, mirrors. He grinned at the soft shock of it, his eyes pulled from one new sight to another. So many things. Objects he had no name for. You looking for anyone in particular, Jack? The man stood in front of a vast fireplace, wearing tight black jeans and a white t-shirt. His feet were bare, and he held a fat glass bulb of liquor in his right hand. Slick blinked at him. Shit, Slick said. You're him. The man swirled the brown stuff up around the edges of the glass and took a swallow. I expected Africa to pull something like this eventually, he said. But somehow, buddy, you don't look like his style of help. You're the Count. Yeah, he said. I'm the Count. Who the fuck are you? Slick. Slick Henry. He laughed. Want some cognac, Slick Henry? He gestured with the glass toward a piece of polished wooden furniture where ornate bottles stood in a row. Each one with a little silver tag hung around it on a chain. Slick shook his head. The man shrugged. Can't get drunk on it anyway. Pardon my saying so, Slick, but you look like shit. Am I correct in guessing that you are not a part of Kid Africa's operation? And if not, just what exactly are you doing here? Gentry sent me. Gentry who? You're the guy on the stretcher, right? The guy on the stretcher is me. Where exactly right this minute is that stretcher, Slick? Gentry's. Where's that? Factory. And where is that? Dog Solitude. And how did I happen to get there, wherever that is? Kid Africa, he brought you. Brought you with this girl named of Cherry, right? See, I owed him a favor. So he wanted me to put you up a while, you and Cherry, and she's taking care of you. You called me Count, Slick. Cherry said Kid called you that once. Tell me, Slick, did the Kid seem worried when he brought me?
Cherry thought he got scared back in Cleveland.
I'm sure he did.
Who's this Gentry? A friend of yours?
Factory's his place. I live there, too.
This Gentry. Is he a cowboy, Slick? A console jockey? I mean, if you're here, he must be technical, right?
Now it was Slick's turn to shrug.
Gentry's like... he's an artist, kind of. Has these theories. Hard to explain. He rigged a set of splitters to that thing on the stretcher, what you're jacked into. First he tried to get an image on a hollow rig, but there was just this monkey thing, sort of shadow. So he talked me into...
Jesus.
Well, never mind. This factory you're talking about, it's out in the sticks somewhere. It's relatively isolated.
Slick nodded.
And this Cherry, she's some kind of hired nurse?
Yeah.
Had a med-tech's ticket, she said. And nobody's come looking for me yet.
No.
That's good, Slick. Because if anyone does, other than my lying rat bastard friend Kid Africa, you folks could find yourselves in serious trouble.
Yeah?
Yeah. Listen to me, okay? I want you to remember this. If any company shows up at this factory of yours, your only hope in hell is to get me jacked into the Matrix. You got that?
How come you're the Count? I mean, what's it mean?
Bobby. My name's Bobby. Count was my handle once, that's all. You think you remember what I told you?
Slick nodded again.
Good. He put his glass down on the thing with all the fancy bottles.
Listen, he said.
From the open door came the sound of tires over gravel.
Know who that is, Slick?
That's Angela Mitchell.
Slick turned.
Bobby, the Count, was looking out at the drive.
Angie Mitchell? The Stim star? She's in this thing, too?
In a manner of speaking, Slick. In a manner of speaking.
Slick saw the long black car slide by.
Hey, he began.
Count, I mean Bobby, what the...
Easy, Gentry was saying. Just sit back. Easy. Easy. 25. Back East. While Kelly and his assistants were assembling her wardrobe for the trip, she felt as though the house itself were stirring around her, preparing for one of its many brief periods of vacancy. She could hear their voices from where she sat in the living room, their laughter. One of the assistants was a girl in a blue polycarbon exo that allowed her to carry the Hermes wardrobe cases as though they were weightless blocks of foam, the humming skeleton suit padding softly down the stairs on its blunt dinosaur feet. Blue skeleton, leather coffins. Now Porphyry stood in the doorway.
Missy ready?
He wore a long, loose coat cut from tissue-thin black leather. Rhinestone spurs glittered above the heels of black patent boots.
Porphyry, she said, you're in mufti. We have an entrance to make in New York.
The cameras are for you.
Yes, she said, for my reinsertion.
Porphyry will keep well in the rear.
I've never known you to worry about upstaging anyone.
He grinned, exposing sculpted teeth, streamlined teeth, an avant-garde dentist's fantasy of what teeth might be like in a faster, more elegant species. Danielle Stark will be flying with us. She heard the sound of the approaching helicopter. She's meeting us at LAX.
We'll strangle her, he said, his tone confidential, as he helped her on with the blue fox Kelly had selected.
If we promise to hint to the facts that the motive was sexual, she might even decide to play along.
You're horrid.
Danielle is a horror, Missy.
Look who's talking.
Ah, said the hairdresser, narrowing his eyes. But my soul is a child's.
Now the helicopter was landing. Danielle Stark, associated with stim versions of both Vogue Nippon and Vogue Europa, was widely rumored to be in her late 80s.
If it were true, Angie thought, covertly inspecting the journalist's figure as the three of them boarded the Lear, Danielle and Porphyry would be on par for overall surgical modification. Apparently, in her willowy early 30s, Her only obvious augments were a pair of pale blue Theis implants. A young French fashion reporter had once referred to these as modishly outdated. The reporter, Net Legend said, had never worked again. And soon, Angie knew, Danielle would want to talk drugs, celebrity drugs, the cornflower eyes schoolgirl-wide to take it all in. Under Porphyry's daunting gaze, Danielle managed to contain herself until they were in cruise mode somewhere over Utah. "I was hoping," she began, "that I wouldn't have to be the one to bring it up." "Danielle," Angie countered, "I am sorry. How thoughtless." She touched the veneered face of the Hosaka flight kitchen, which purred softly and began to dispense tiny plates of tea-smoked duck, Gulf oysters on black pepper toast, crayfish flan, sesame pancakes. Porphyry, taking Angie's cue, produced a bottle of chilled Chablis, Danielle's favorite, Angie now recalled. Someone, Swift, had also remembered. "Drugs," Danielle said, 15 minutes later, finishing the last of the duck. "Don't worry," Porphyry assured her. "When you get to New York, they have anything you want." Danielle smiled. "You're so amusing. Do you know I've a copy of your birth certificate? I know your real name." She looked at him meaningfully, still smiling. "Sticks and stones," he said, topping up her glass. "Interesting notation regarding congenital defects." She sipped her wine. "Congenital, genital. We all change so much these days, don't we? Who's been doing your hair, dear?" He leaned forward. "Your saving grace, Danielle, is that you make the rest of your kind look vaguely human." Danielle smiled. The interview itself went smoothly enough. Danielle was too skilled an interviewer to allow her feints to cross the pain threshold, where they might rally serious resistance. But when she brushed a fingertip back across her temple, depressing a subdermal switch that deactivated her recording gear, Angie tensed for the real onslaught. "Thank you," Danielle said. "The rest of the flight, of course, is off the record." "Why don't you just have another bottle or two and turn in?" Porphyry asked. "What I don't see, dear," Danielle said, ignoring him, "is why you bothered." "Why I bothered, Danielle? Going to that tedious clinic at all. You said it didn't affect your work. You've also said there was no high, not in the usual sense." She giggled. "Though you do maintain that it was such a terribly addictive substance. Why did you decide to quit?" "It was terribly expensive." "In your case, surely that's academic." True, Angie thought, though a week of it did cost something in the vicinity of your annual salary. "I suppose I began to resent paying to feel normal, or a poor approximation of normal." "Did you build up a tolerance?"
"No."
"How odd."
"Not really. These designers provide substances that supposedly bypass the traditional drawbacks."
"Ah. But what about the new drawbacks? The now drawbacks?" Danielle poured herself more wine. "I've heard another version of all this, of course."
"You have?"
"Of course I have. What it was, who made it, why you quit."
"Yes?"
"It was an antipsychotic, produced in SenseNet's own labs. You quit taking it because you'd rather be crazy." Porphyry gently took the glass from Danielle's hand as her lids fluttered heavily over the brilliant blue eyes. "Nighty-night, dear," he said. Danielle's eyes closed and she began to snore gently.
"Porphyry, what?"
"I dosed her wine," he said. "She won't know the difference, Missy. She won't remember anything she didn't record." He grinned broadly. "You really didn't want to have to listen to this bitch all the way back, did you?"
"But she'll know, Porphyry."
"No, she won't. We'll tell her she killed 3 bottles by herself and made a disgusting mess in the washroom. And she'll feel like it, too." He giggled. Danielle Stark was still snoring, quite loudly now, in one of the 2 swing-down bunks in the rear of the cabin.
"Porphyry," Angie said, "do you think she might have been right?"
The hairdresser gazed at her with his gorgeous, inhuman eyes.
"And you wouldn't have known?"
I don't know.
He sighed. Missy worries too much. You're free now. Enjoy it.
I do hear voices, Porphyry.
Don't we all, Missy?
No, she said. Not like mine. Do you know anything about African religions, Porphyry?
He smirked.
I'm not African.
But when you were a child...
When I was a child, Porphyry said, I was white.
Oh.
He laughed. Religions, Missy?
Before I came to the net, I had friends in New Jersey. They were black and religious.
He smirked again and rolled his eyes. Hoodoo sign, Missy. Chicken bone and pennyroyal oil.
You know it isn't like that.
And if I do?
Don't tease me, Porphyry. I need you.
Missy has me. And yes, I know what you mean.
And those are your voices?
They were. After I began to use the dust, they went away.
And now?
They're gone. But the impulse was past now, and she cringed from trying to tell him about Grande Brigitte and the drug in the jacket.
Good, he said. That's good, Missy.
The Lear began its descent over Ohio. Porphyry was staring at the bulkhead, still as a statue. Angie looked out at the cloud country below as it rose toward them, remembering the game she'd played on airplanes as a child, sending an imaginary Angie out to romp through cloud canyons and over fluffy peaks grown magically solid. Those planes had belonged to Mas Neotech, she supposed. From the Mas corporate jets, she'd gone on to Net Lears. She knew commercial airliners only as locations for her stims. New York to Paris on the maiden flight of JAL's restored Concorde, with Robin and a hand-picked party of net people. Descending. Were they over New Jersey yet? Did the children swarming the rooftop playgrounds of Beauvoir's Arcology hear the Lear's engine? Did the sound of her passage sweep faintly over the condos of Bobby's childhood? How unthinkably intricate the world was, in sheer detail of mechanism, when SenseNet's corporate will shook tiny bones in the ears of unknown, unknowing children. Porphyry knows certain things, he said very softly. But Porphyry needs time to think, Missy. They were banking for the final approach. 26. Kuromaku. And Sally was silent, on the street and in the cab, all the long cold way back to their hotel. Sally and Swain were being blackmailed by Sally's enemy up the well. Sally was being forced to kidnap Angie Mitchell. The thought of someone's abducting the SenseNet star struck Kumiko as singularly unreal, as if someone were plotting to assassinate a figure out of myth. The Finn had implied that Angie herself was already involved in some mysterious way, but he had used words and idioms Kumiko hadn't understood. Something in cyberspace. People forming pacts with a thing or things there. The Finn had known a boy who became Angie's lover, but wasn't Robin Lanier her lover? Kumiko's mother had allowed her to run several of the Angie and Robin stims. The boy had been a cowboy, a data thief, like Tick in London. And what of the enemy, the blackmailer? She was mad, Finn said, and her madness had brought about the decline of her family's fortune. She lived alone in her ancestral home, the house called Straylight. What had Sally done to earn her enmity? Had she really killed this woman's father? And who were the others who had died? Already she'd forgotten the Gaijin name. And had Sally learned what she'd wanted to learn in visiting the Finn? Kumiko had waited, finally, for some pronouncement from the armored shrine, but the exchange had wound down to nothing, to a Gaijin ritual of joking goodbye. In the hotel lobby, Petal was waiting in a blue velour armchair. Dressed for travel, his bulk encased in three-piece gray wool,
He rose from the chair like some strange balloon as they entered, eyes mild as ever behind steel-rimmed glasses.
"Hello," he said, and coughed. "Swain's sent me after you, only to mind the girl, you see."
"Take her back," Sally said. "Now, tonight." "Sally, no!"
But Sally's hand was already locked firmly around Kumiko's upper arm, pulling her toward the entrance to the darkened lounge off the lobby.
"Wait there,"
Sally snapped at Petal. "Listen to me," she said, tugging Kumiko around the corner into shadow. "You're going back. I can't keep you here now." "But I don't like it there. I don't like Swain or his house.
Petal's okay," Sally said, leaning close and speaking quickly. "In a pinch, I'd say trust him.
Swain, well, you know what Swain is, but he's your father's. Whatever comes down, I think they'll keep you out of the way. But if it gets bad, really bad, go to the pub where we met Tick, the Rose and Crown. Remember?"
Kumiko nodded, her eyes filling with tears. "If Tick's not there, find a barman named Bevan and mention my name."
"Sally, I..."
"You're okay," Sally said, and kissed her abruptly, one of her lenses brushing for an instant against Kumiko's cheekbone, startlingly cold and unyielding.
"Me, baby, I'm gone."
And she was, into the muted tinkle of the lounge, and Petal cleared his throat in the entranceway. The flight back to London was like a very long subway ride.
Petal passed the time in scribing words, a letter at a time, in some idiotic puzzle in an English fax, grunting softly to himself. Eventually she slept and dreamed of her mother.
"Heater's working," Petal said, driving back to Swain's from Heathrow.
It was uncomfortably warm in the Jaguar, a dry heat that smelled of leather and made her sinuses ache. She ignored him, staring out at the wan morning light, at roofs shining black through melting snow, rows of chimney pots.
"He's not angry with you, you know," Petal said.
"He feels a special responsibility. Giri. Yes. Responsible, you see.
Sally has never been what you'd call predictable, really. But we didn't expect..."
"I don't wish to talk, thank you." His small worried eyes in the mirror.
The crescent was lined with parked cars, long silver-gray cars with tinted windows. "Seeing a lot of visitors this week," Petal said, parking opposite number 17. He got out, opened the door for her.
She followed him numbly across the street and up the gray steps, where the black door was opened by a squat, red-faced man in a tight, dark suit, Petal brushing past him as though he weren't there.
"Hold on," Red Face said. "Swain will see her now." The man's words brought Petal up short.
With a grunt, he spun around with disconcerting speed and caught the man by his lapel. "In future, show some fucking respect," Petal said, and though he hadn't raised his voice, somehow all of its weary gentleness was gone.
Kumiko heard stitches pop. "Sorry, Gov." The red face was carefully blank.
"He told me to tell you."
End of Side 4. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.